Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Jeff Taylor with TechCrunch, and I want to welcome you to our 350 session at TechCrunch Early Stage. You have arrived in breakout room one, and you are going to be listening to Setting the Foundation for Built to Last Companies with Rajiv Batra from Mayfield and with Manny Medina from Outreach. Rajiv, thank you so much for being here today. It's a pleasure to have you.
Jeff, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. All right, I think we're on.
We are.
All right. How are we gonna do this?
I don't sit well, so I'm just gonna stand here. If that's okay with everyone. That way I can see everyone in the back.
Am I allowed to sit?
You can sit.
Yeah. It's gonna be kinda odd though.
I don't think I can stand.
All right. It'll depend whether if I get tired, maybe I'll sit.
Yeah,
down.
You can sit down, that's right.
With you standing, sometimes I do get tired. So well, welcome everybody. My name is Rajiv Batra. I'm a partner at Mayfield, a venture firm that's been supporting early stage entrepreneurs for over 50 years and has invested and partnered with over 550 entrepreneurs, such as Manny Medina. I'd like to introduce Manny Medina here. He's co-founder and CEO of Outreach. And our journey together began I think over 10 years ago, maybe 10 or 11 years ago.
Yeah.
When we first met, I told Manny that his, I really loved
you
him.
You voted against me.
I voted against him.
There That's right.
Go. So I voted against him. That's how we met. That's how we met. We had a spirited conversation where I sort of was like, you know,
You didn't want me to find out that you voted against me. That's how it went.
That's how it went. And so that's how our relationship started. We've talked about it often in public and written about it. But the reality was, here was an entrepreneur with an incredible story, a personal story, going down the path of innovation, and has a really interesting, fascinating background that he'll get into. And I was just struck by that and his desire to change and impact the world. I just wasn't crazy about the first idea he pitched me, but we stayed in touch and Outreach has been an incredible journey since we started working together about 7 years ago this month.
Yeah.
Manny Medina.
Thank you. I'm Manny Medina, co-founder of Outreach. Outreach is a sales execution platform. And for those who don't know what that means, and you're gonna run into this a lot if you're starting your own category, it's a place where a rep lives, takes all their actions, and the execution platform helps the rep perform better and achieve their full revenue potential. And what drives us is the fact that we're changing reps' lives. And sales is one of those functions that is important to the organization because it's important to anyone who's B2B and selling something. But it's a great equalizer in society, because to be a great rep, you don't need a degree, you don't need to be poor or rich, you can be an immigrant, you can be of any color, you can see yourself as anything you want. And you deliver the number and you win. And when reps win, especially those who come from humble backgrounds, they elevate their families, their communities, and they really pay back. So for us, making the rep, the sales profession greater, making them achieve their full potential was our true north. And it's always been, when we started Outreach, which is not common for B2B companies, so you hear a lot of PLG, right? Raise your hand. You heard of PLG, right? Everybody's heard of PLG. Yeah? Yeah, everybody wants to be PLG. That's a new thing, right? And before PLG, there was a lot of talk about how to ramp sales and run sales teams, et cetera. We did the worst of both worlds. We were selling products to individuals, which is not supposed to be that way. You're supposed to be sales for individuals and sell products company. No, we sold products to individuals because we were selling it to salespeople. And to salespeople, if you make them successful, they buy. And not only they buy, but they tell their friends. And that was the best, that was the best way to build a company, because you, by selling to individuals, they also call you when something doesn't work. And they also tell you when something is working. They also refer their friends directly to you. That allows us to build a really good product really early on that took off, you know, once we hit scale. And that's the genesis and the short of what we do.
That's great. Manny, so let's talk a little bit about the backstory. How did you actually come to do Outreach? Because Outreach has an inception story and sort of a pivot story.
Yep.
And all startups, all great startups have some sort of inception and pivot. So maybe you can comment a little bit on that phase.
Yeah. So when Outreach outreach is a pivot, and now outreach is a pivot, and very few investors invest in pivots. That's what makes Rajiv special, that he invested in a pivot, which means that your cap table is dirty with a bunch of other people who invested in a company that is no longer anymore, that the founders don't have as much equity because you got diluted on the way. There's a lot of hair in pivots. It takes courage to invest in a pivot. But pivots work out. Slack was a pivot. Pivots work out. So outreach began in 2011. I met my co-founders, and we decided to crack the problem of recruiting. So we decided that we're going to be building a marketplace, and that marketplace was going to have profiles, and we're going to attract employers, and things were going to spin out of control, and we're all going to be great and rich and change the world. That did not happen. And in December 2013, we found ourselves with 2 months of cash left. And as I mentioned before, people don't like the fun pivots. So I couldn't raise to get ourselves out of trouble. So we looked at the four of us co-founders, and we decided that we're going to stop developing features and try to solve our way out of features. And we're going to develop things that allows us to sell more. So we did the math, and we figured that if we 10x the number of meetings that our two reps were driving, the conversion rates will allow us to generate enough cash to make payroll. So we did that. We built a workflow that did two things, that it personalized emails at scale, and I can get into that if you want to at the end of the session, and then follow up automatically so that it felt like we were reaching out in a personalized way. So we did. We built this workflow, and we did 10x our meeting generation, but we could not close this meeting fast enough and generate cash. So now I have 1 month left of cash. So I turn around and I went to agency recruiters who get paid per placement. And I said, I can generate meetings for you. And if you do the conversion, I can, this could be very profitable. But meeting generation, it works in sales as a service. It doesn't work in recruiting as a service. So every agency recruiter will look at us and be like, you have, why? How do you do this? You don't do that. We don't buy meetings. And I told them, well, we build this workflow that, does this thing and generates a lot of meetings. And they're like, stop. I want to buy that workflow. I don't want to buy your service. And I had about, 50 meetings like that. I went back to my co-founder and said, hey, guys, we had a shot here of like pivoting the company and build a workflow engine for recruiting. So we did that. And that's when we met Rajiv. So we went and rebuilt it. And now we're trying to get money to finish the job. And we went to pitch at the Harvard, what was it, entrepreneur competition or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, Harvard Business School Entrepreneurship Comp.
And I was confident I was winning because everybody else had really bad ideas. Like mine was bad, but the other ones were worse. And you heard the term, right? Like I don't have to run the bear, I have to run you. So I just have to be better than, the low bar that was in the room. And my friend Rajiv voted against me, which was a deciding vote. And I swear to everyone that I will never talk to him again. Matter of fact, not only I will never talk to him again, whatever he invested in, I will make sure that I will compete in him. So fast forward, now we're trying to sell this recruiting engine to recruiters, and recruiters are not, are really hard to sell to. And then one company that did buy it was AppDynamics, and AppDynamics, the recruiting team, bought us. And I'm trying to get more out of them. And I'm like, is there more seats? Is there something else I can do for you? And they were like, no. But, what you do is very similar to what SDRs do. So it's the recruiter literally grabbed my hand, walked me over to the SDR pit, and called the SDR manager over, and he's like, do a demo for him. And I did a demo for him, and they bought in the spot, 50 seats. And I went back to my co-founders, and was like, guess what we're doing? We're doing workflows for sales. And that really took off. And it took off because the word sales stack began being evangelized by the likes of Lemkin and so on and so forth. And they started posting about, what's in your stack? What are you doing? And I was selling door to door. And that's the other thing that I advise founders to do. I was in this, I was crashing somebody's office and using a desk in a Union Square. And so I would set up meetings in the financial district, and people would be like, when are you setting a video conferencing link? And I'm like, no, I'm downstairs. And when you pitch a person in person, it's really hard to say no. It's really hard to say like, no, I'm not going to try it. So I would make people part with the money on the regular just by selling face to face. And that's how it got us to about $500,000 in AR. And that's when Rajiv and I re-met. And, I'll let you tell your own story.
Yeah. The journey in meeting Manny, first being struck by this incredible energy of somebody wanting to change the world and not taking no for an answer, right? So one incredible quality of an entrepreneur. Most great entrepreneurs don't like hearing that their idea, is not necessarily great, but in Manny's case, he was open to a real thorough conversation. So the first time we met around the recruiting marketplace idea, a 45-minute meeting turned into a two-hour conversation. Debate, heated, but a conversation nevertheless.
Just to give you a context, he was sitting in this long mahogany table, kind of like Putin. He was like on the other end of the table, I'm over here. So we're having this vigorous debate on a very long distance table.
That's right, that's right. It looked like a scene out of a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
Actually, it felt like that to you. We were actually sitting right next to each other. And fast forward a couple of years when they were working on this pivot and the HBS competition thing, he still won't actually ever get the real reason why I said no. I never will tell him that. But the reality was he was still going up into the recruiting world. And today, in the last couple of years, obviously recruiting technology is seeing an incredible resurgence. But 7-8 years ago, it was really, really difficult place to be. Right. Everybody talked about recruiting tech, but nobody wanted to invest in it. And I knew something about that because I was involved with a couple of companies in that space that are actually doing quite well now. But it was a really, really hard grind. Right. So now moving to salespeople, now that's a world that I love, having been involved with companies like Marketo and in the first generation of CRM predating Salesforce. Now, Manny was, I felt like, applying what they knew and their energy, the four founders, into a market that really truly deserved innovation, real innovation. Nobody had really invested truly in sales tech until 2013, 14, 15. It sounds like everything is now sales tech, but 7-8 years ago, if entrepreneurs were starting something in sales tech, most people would be skeptical and they'd say, well, Salesforce would do it, right? That name is called Salesforce. But that market really needed innovation, and it needed outside-in thinking, which is what Manny and the team were bringing to the table, a completely new way of thinking about engagement and building something for the reps and changing their lives and changing the lives of their customers and ushering in innovation through bringing revenue-generating technology to the table. And that's when I sort of literally chased Manny and said, the past is the past. We can only look forward. And you know, let's really truly team up together. And this actually speaks to Manny and the values of outreach and how that started creating the foundation very early on in terms of the values informing the culture, and you know how Manny and the team really think about truly thinking about different ideas, competing ideas, coming from all different places, whether they're your own or not, having a seat at the table, including somebody who had said no twice, and taking their call seriously and saying, okay, what do you have to say? So maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the you know, how you've thought about building the culture of the company. Has this been an afterthought or something that started early in the journey of outreach?
Yeah, there was a panel here before, I don't know if everybody, so I overheard saying, you know, what's the right number of co-founders? And when we were starting outreach, there was four of us, and we were all told that we're gonna fail, that there's no such thing as four co-founders. So there's always two, top three, but four is just not. It turns out four co-founders was the best thing that could happen to us because it forced me. So let me take a step back. I'm a CEO because I'm the worst coder out of the four co-founders. So everybody else was busy, so I got to do whatever else was not doing. That's called CEO in early stage. Much later, you get the glory of the benefit of being a CEO, but early on doesn't mean anything. So having my co-founders meant that everybody, you know, even if I was the CEO, which is technically their boss, means that I still have to explain to them why we do what we do. So and, you know, you're also the bearer of energy. Early startups are founded on energy, meaning if you know, there's going to be a lot of downs, there's going to be a lot of bad news, there's going to be a lot of rough spots. And if you as a leader, you're not bringing it. You're not getting everybody up. You're not making everyone believe. You're not recentering everyone on the vision. The startup fails and it falls apart. Having three other co-founders really cemented that, you know, everything that we do, even now that we have over 1,200 people, has to come from a point of empathy, has to come from a point of caring for you, meaning my coworker, our customer, and the business as a whole. So being really early.
Your VCs sometimes.
And the VCs, yeah, when they're behaving.
Sometimes.
But if you do all that, it's kind of like the Johnson & Johnson thing. Like, if you take care of the people, you take care of your customers, everything else sort of takes care of itself. Like, you know, VCs will make money on that. And having four co-founders really forced me to sell everything that I wanted to get done. So I couldn't just walk around and tell people what to do, because my co-founders would just look at me like, no. So and then what, right? So that practice of selling internally, even at the early stages, of really caring for each other, of really, you know, taking turns of lifting each other up, and we were a diverse bunch. I'm a Latino immigrant. My co-founders are all in their 20s, or they were in their 20s at the time, and from Washington State. So, you know, there were, you know, three white guys and myself, really made us more powerful. And, you know, we hit about, I don't know, like, I think it was 25 or 50 million AR. We decided that, we, you know, we really need to keep this it was 10. We really need to keep this and lock it and, like, make sure that we cement this foundation so that we can grow, you know, grow much bigger, that we continue to live these values, you know, even at 1,000 people. So we did it out of respect for each other and honoring what we had built on the back of each other's work. So we have one core value, for instance. You know, we have grit as a core value that is very important, but we have another core value that is not as well known, which is having each other's back. And that's a true core value. And people will get fired at Outreach if you cannot demonstrate that you have done that in the past. And having that codified in your early, in the early DNA allows you to scale it out and tell stories on, you know, when do you have somebody's back and somebody else is having each other's back. And, you know, now that we are in like 10 countries and 1,200 people, the stories keep repeating themselves and people tell each other stories of their own doing and having each other's back. So that was one of the attributes of starting, you know, with four co-founders and really locking in on who we wanted to be when we grow up.
And you know, there's a lot of talk about DEI, right? Like, you know, people from diverse backgrounds and ideas and being inclusive. How has Outreach been intentional? Has it been sort of something that just fell in your lap because you're a Latino immigrant and you know, or was there intentionality, and was it random chance meeting intentionality? What has that journey been about, and how has that actually informed building great products and great performance, right? So is it just a thing at Outreach, or?
Yeah. It began with us and the fact that we are different. We come from different walks of life. And we were about 50 people. We sat down and we decided to lock the values. One of the values that we locked was the fact that we found strength in diversity, meaning we need diversity of thought, of walks of life, of color, of experiences, to be able to add to the culture, but also to the product and to our success. We're also very fortunate in that we sell to salespeople. And salespeople can come from all walks of life. So you can't have a homogeneous culture in selling to a heterogeneous market, because it's not gonna fit. So we have to align who we are to the people that we're selling to. And second of all, also comes from the fact that our first, because we're a pivot, when we raise our seed round, the previous board member were like, all right, I'm out, because that's not the company that I funded. So we were left without a board. And I asked Sarah Imbach to be on my board. And she was transformational. And having that experience made me realize, like, you know, what if I have an entire staff that kind of look like her? So fast forward to today, half of my directs are female. So, you know, 45% of the executive team at Outreach is female. Almost 50% of the entire company is female. But, you know, it begins at the top, right? So if you're intentional about the kind of people that you want to bring, you know, what are you getting from them and why do you want to build it that way? Then it sort of propagates as you're building it. It's really hard to retrofit that later. Meaning if you are, you know, if you're 100 dudes and then you want to be diverse, it's really hard to like bring somebody who is not from your background, because they're not going to be accepted. You know, there's going to be a rejection in the tissue. And especially in tech companies, it's, you know, the word that we use is cultural fit. But cultural fit could be poisonous if your culture is homogeneous and they all look the same. So that just means I'm going to bring people who look just like me, and then you're going to propagate the problem even further. So you have to be intentional, and intentionality means two things. Intentionality means that you think about, you know, who you want to be when you're 1,000 people, and you start solving that today. And second of all is that you allow yourself to make mistakes. Because if you're really trying to push the boundaries of who belongs in your company, you will make mistakes. They will show up in Glassdoor, and that's okay. If you're not, then you're a homogeneous culture. The easiest way to get a great Glassdoor review is to fill the room with people who look the same, because everybody's going to be super happy to be there. But if you're really intentional about bringing diverse backgrounds, then you're going to make a mistake, and that has to be okay, because you learn. And then you treat it very humanly, and you move forward, but you need to grow.
When you think about, we often sort of think about, three sort of pillars for companies that sort of have this inception to iconic sort of arc. One is some unique technology product insight to a market that changes the dynamics of that industry, right? And you're doing that with sales engagement and execution. And the second is sort of a unique business model, right? You're changing the unit economics, the margin structure of the industry, or how people actually get value. And Outreach is a product that reps live in like 4 to 5 days, four days out of five. They're in it throughout the whole day. That's truly the power of software, which, you know, you can't say a lot of software people sit in all day, especially in the sales space. And the third most important is sort of the people operating system, the culture.
Yep.
That kind of outlasts probably everything, because the markets are going to keep evolving and changing. How do you feel about, you're building this incredible culture that's inclusive, can continue to adapt. It's in your DNA, very difficult to retrofit, hard to compete against that in many ways. How do you sort of think about, we talked a lot about empathy, having each other's back. How do you think about the accountability aspects, the performance aspects? You know, we talk about empathetically performant cultures.
Yeah.
Do you think the two are mutually exclusive? I know this is a setup for you, but oftentimes, right, like, and there are a lot of shows out there these days on Uber and Theranos and this, that, and the other, and they tend to take one point of view or the other, that either you can be empathetic or performance driven, but not necessarily both. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, but I think it's a false dichotomy. This is the interesting part, is that a startup, by definition, you need to push the boundaries. I remember this one conversation that we had at the very beginning, and that, you have some amount of churn in your base. And we were really worried about it, and we're trying to solve the problem, trying to figure out where it comes. And you told us in a board meeting that if you didn't have some amount of churn when you're early, you're not trying hard enough. You always sell yourself this big TAM, right? Like everybody has a massive TAM with like billions and whatever. But that TAM is not really addressable to you until you go and sell it, until they're using your product and somehow getting benefit of it. So if you're not like going outside of your TAM and experimenting with things, you're not going to learn how big your TAM is. So for instance, we tried to sell into automotive really early on, and clearly we didn't have a fit because automotive used a different CRM. People are, in the lots, et cetera. Like there's a number of reasons why like it was hard. And so we signed a few customers, we lost them after a few, and we were really worried about that churn. And what the culture is really what propagated the fact that we went and tried it, right? If I would have gone and yelled at the person who went and sold against automotive, and why didn't you stick the landing? Why didn't you call us? Why didn't you did it? You would have created a culture of fear, and that propagates quickly. And the earlier, when that happens early, that becomes an ethos, and then that ethos propagates. So that doesn't mean that we're not accountable, but it means that by having each other's back, by making sure that, we're giving it our best, that we're gritting it out, then, you can still be grateful for the effort, even if you did not get the result. And that's what's really important, is that, performance is a series of things that lead to a result. Any breakage in that series of things causes non-performance. So that doesn't mean that we're not caring about performance. We we're being on one of the fastest growing B2B SaaS companies in the world. You don't become that by not being performing. But you can be that and have each other's back. You can be that and fail. You can be that and, you know, grow people. And instead of like, you know, churning and firing everybody, you know, as you're growing and hiring that, you know, that VP that has been there, done that. So the question is, the question is, how much are you willing to put work into it? You know, the advice that you see out there mostly comes from people who've never run a company before or built anything. So don't take it. Talk to your team. Go and think about who you want to be. What are your principles? You know, what are trade-offs and what is not a trade-off? And then build that company. And that's sort of what we learned from doing this, is that, you know, we were going to optimize for one metric at the very beginning, which is revenue. We're going to go make revenue go up to the right. Matter of fact, it wasn't even revenue, it was cash. When Rajiv got involved, we were running the company on a cash basis. There was no accrual. So we didn't count the revenue until somebody swipe a credit card or, you know, kind of like a drug dealer operation, if you know what I'm saying. Like, you know, cash came in, cash went out, that was it. And by being really focused on that element of survival, that got everyone aligned and that got everyone, you know, incentivized into one thing, right? Then we became revenue driven, then we became, you know, ARR driven, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we were always clear about what we were trying to optimize. And we're also clear about our values. And as long as you have those things together, you can build a big, great company that is also very caring and empathetic.
So talking about building big companies, they often require you to innovate and create a category. How's that, all of what you just discussed, set you up to define and create the category you operate in? And you're starting to even operate and sort of lead multiple categories now. Mm. Was that, how important was that, this whole process, and what is the category you're in today?
So the category that we have created now for ourselves is called sales execution. Before then, we invented a category called sales engagement, and we decided that that category wasn't encompassing enough of the problem that we were solving. Our customers were asking to solve a bigger problem. So we redefined the category to something that solves every customer problem. When you start a company, you will have a decision as to whether you're going to disrupt a category or you're going to invent your own one. And I don't know, like, if you read Frank Slootman's book, I don't know if you read it, great read. You should go and read it, because there's a lot of nuggets there. He advises against you going and founding new categories. He tells you to go and disrupt the current category. Category creation is for lunatics. I'm not a young founder, so I only got one shot in me. So I'm not going to go and build a disruptor to whatever. I'm going to build my own thing because I only got one shot. So my perspective from the category building was that, you know, we're going to build a category because that's what's more exciting. I can get my founders behind that rallying cry. Culturally also, we were inventing based on what their customer was saying, not what the market was saying, but what the customer needed. And if you follow the customer and they pay you for it, you can call that whatever you want. Matter of fact, if you call it something special, all of a sudden your customers become part of that special thing and you're creating a community. So not only you have a business now, but you have a community. You bring those two things together and you call it a category. And now our customers are part of the sales engagement category. Nobody, like, there's no rep that believes that they're part of the CRM category. Like, they don't wake up and thinking, you know, I'm going to CRM today. But they all wake up thinking, I'm going to engage today, I'm going to make some money. So if you call that a name that is special and they belong to that, now all of a sudden you create a tribe, and a tribe becomes a movement, and the movement becomes something that raises you and allows you to, you know, to expand, to evangelize your product for free. That's why it's worthwhile doing it, but it's a long journey.
And a lot of people floating around now, in suddenly sales tech is hot, it's exciting. What do you think has set you up for, or why are you succeeding today? Like, is there some special sauce that Outreach has?
I think we just fuck up less every day, and that sets us apart. Yeah. I think that
that's a technical term.
Yes, right. I think that what, because of our roots of needing to survive and needing to have our customer pay us for the product to survive. We developed this sort of like innate need of customer validation. And we needed to have everything customer validated for us to put more wood behind it. And customer validation, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it, et cetera. But for us, is would the customer pay for it? And the customer only pays for it if the customer gets value from it. So this is why, you know, I think there's a lot of distraction around, you know, the usage funnel and all these metrics, and the metrics abstract the real feedback from a real human touching your product, getting value from it, and swiping a credit card and paying you for it, or going to their boss and saying, can I please buy this? So I think that is that obsession of making sure that, you know, we're aligned with the customer, that has propagated through the culture. And now the product managers do that. The engineers think about it that way. Our customer success people think about it that way. You know, our reps are a little different, that they really want to get into the weeds. Because if you get into a customer conversation and it gets technical, the rep wants to be able to navigate that herself. So I think that, again, that's a cultural thing. And it became from the fact that we almost died as a company. And if it wasn't for the few customers that pay us, you know, we would not be here. So we have this tremendous amount of gratitude towards, you know, the customers that, that kept us alive, and now to the customers that keeps us growing.
And talk a little bit about, you know, the categories. You're not just in one category, you're in multiple categories.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of maintain sort of leadership as you now have multiple products, multiple categories, and arguably, you know, you're doing this, you know, sooner than a lot of other companies tend to do at their sort of stage of growth.
Yeah.
Do they inform each other? Are they part of a bigger whole? Or how do you sort of think about that?
Yeah, so for us, it was kind of like, I think my co-founder Andrew Kinzer used to call it this way, was sort of, then how many people have kids here? Because maybe just around Alice. All right, not that many. All right, so it's kind of like Alice in Wonderland going down the rabbit hole. Like, you solve a problem for the customer, and the customer likes it so much, and it's such a big deal that you solve the problem for them, that the customer asks, hey, I have this other problem. Do you mind solving it for me? Then you kind of like go sit down with your co-founders, your technical team, and if you solve that problem, then they ask you to solve the next problem. And in children's book, there is a book called If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, and it's a beautiful book, and if you have children, buy it for them, where, you know, you give the mouse a cookie, and the mouse asks you for milk, and then he asks you for a napkin, and then he wants to take a bath, and like it's a very long book that is kind of like easy to follow, but it's the same thing. Like, you know, you give the customer a cookie, and all of a sudden the customer says, you have milk. And then after you have milk, it's like, you know, let's go play after that. And so the customer sort of pulls you one direction. And as long as you think that that direction is something you can deliver and be differentiated, you follow the customer. And if you follow the customer, you know, you solve this problem. And we called the first problem that we solved was engagement. And engagement for us was pipeline generation per rep. And pipeline generation per rep means that either you're an SDR or you're a rep that needs to generate its own pipeline. And that's hugely valuable, right? Because if you don't generate enough pipeline, you're not going to make your number. So we sort of like, you know, we sold a little bit of new business insurance for reps. And then after we solved that problem, then our customers were like, can you help us forecast that problem? Or can you help us close that pipeline? So we continued to add products. We continue, you know, we fail, we add new products, some products work, some products didn't work. But then at some point you have to realize that to really encompass the whole of the problem, you need to redefine the problem and then redefine the category by which you're solving the problem. So the first problem that we solved was engagement, but then the next problem we called it the sales execution gap, which is all these different things that are keeping you from delivering the number that you want to deliver that are gaps in execution. And they're all over the place. And if you really start looking closely, you know, there could be gaps in pipeline. There could be gaps in conversion. There could be gaps in how you run a meeting. It could be gaps in, you know, how many people you're involving in a deal. There's all these gaps in sales that we decided to call the whole thing the sales execution gap. And once we call the problem, and this is literally out of Christopher Lockhead's book, once you name and frame the problem, you can name and frame the category. So the first thing you do is you look for the problems that you're solving for the customer and based on customer feedback, and then you name the category based on what you think you're going to solve it. And once you solve it and you go for it, then you look for two points of evidence. Are your competitors calling it that too? And then you won because you got momentum. And two, are the analysts calling it that? And at that point, you're made. Like, as you're king, you won, and you move on to the next problem.
That's great. So Manny, let's shift topics slightly to your your development evolution as a leader, as a CEO, as a founder CEO. This is the first time you've been a CEO, right? This is your first time CEO.
Yeah.
You started the company with three other people, so you were four people.
Yeah.
I think when we got met up and got involved, maybe 10, 12 people, something like that. Now, over 1,000.
1,200.
1,200. How has your own journey as a leader been? How have you sort of adapted, evolved? Have you changed?
So it has. And so it ha- one of the things that that I talk about is that how your motivation and what gives you energy changes. So when we started Outreach, our motivation was not to die. So we were motivated out of fear, out of running out of cash, out of like, would a customer churn? We were, you know, that really kept us alive. Like it's this panic that we would just have to go and get a real job somewhere else. So, you know, once we started generating enough revenue and we realized that dying is not going to be the next thing, you know, the next thing that came into our mind is like, you know, Rajiv comes in and brings, you know, his partners and, you know, gives a term sheet. And I'm like, oh my God, this is real. We can be rich. So then you get into this mode of like, you know, how big can this be? You know, what are we going to do with all this wealth? And sometimes you take your founders and you go for a drink and you, you know, dream about, you know, the things that you're going to do with the money you have. That's very short lived. Because then you realize that, oh, for us, it happened in this way. We were coming in one morning to, you know, do work, and we get a call from a customer. The system is down. It's 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. East Coast time. Customer is in New York. System is down. And he said, it was 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 East. The customer said, I just sent my entire sales team out to lunch early because they can't sell if you're not on Outreach. You better fix it in the next hour because that's when they're coming back. And then we went back to that first panic of like, oh my God, we're going to die. Everyone's going to churn. We're done. So we went into this deep, like, you know, panic mode, solve the problem, get the customers back up. We solved it in an hour and a half and we avoided this problem. So then at the end of the day, we're reflecting and we're realizing that when the customer call and they say we're running on Outreach, that's people's livelihoods. That means that that rep is not making their commission number. It's not, you know, buying whatever they want to buy. It's not sending their kids to college. There's something they're not doing if they're not on Outreach. So all of a sudden, we grew from that sense of greed to a sense of duty. Now we have people relying on Outreach. And it's our duty to keep them up. It's our duty to educate them. It's our duty to make them better. And I feel like that's the strongest sense of motivation. It's the fact that you are working for somebody else. Your motivation is externally driven. Because that digs a hole in a well that you don't have access to unless you have to live through other people and you have to give it to somebody else. You know, and from then it's about, you know, loving what you do. Like this category creation thing is something that we really, really, really love. Because you get to invent, it's like a white canvas. You get to invent what's next. So that sense of motivation of going from, you know, fear to greed to duty and love has been our journey as we grow and my journey as a leader. Because now my job is to instill that sense of duty to the entire organization in the form of stories, in speeches, in, you know, quarterly announcements and whatever it is. You know, I'm sort of like the Pied Piper of a very large group that needs to run on this next level sense of energy. And that's how I've grown as a leader myself.
You still take support tickets once in a while?
I still take support tickets once in a while.
Sales calls?
I prospect once a month.
Prospect once a month. Still living in the product.
Of course. But that's an important lesson is that, you know, you develop your own leadership style as a founder. But mine was that I would never ask anybody to do something I wouldn't do myself. Just a full stop. Even if I didn't know what I was doing. I need to learn to be able to really commiserate at the most fundamental level of the job to be done. Otherwise, I don't think I would be an appropriate leader. So, you know, taking a ticket to really understand how support is doing earns me the credibility of support. That I've been there with them. You know, successing a customer with a success team, the same thing. If I'm prospecting along with my sales team, they know that a leader has their back. So, you know, you do you, but that's how my leadership style has evolved over time.
Any last words for the audience? Advice, one piece of advice? You got 7 seconds.
Do it for the love of the game. Look at yourself internally and make sure that you, you know, pour your life into something that you're really gonna love, and you do it for somebody else. Don't do it for yourself.
Great. Thank you, Manny.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
I really enjoyed you at the Flip the Script event a few months ago.
I guess let me just turn this off.